Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. And we'll start with the Sunday Times. The story about John Delaney is over all of the papers. But of course, it was the Sunday Times that broke it last week. And it was the Sunday Times that went to court on the issue. So they lead with the headline, FAI chief John Delaney steps aside amid financial queries. Football body makes new role for old boss. And then they have other stories, Limerick Gardaí face corruption inquiry and meaty rise in Goodman's riches. Now, the Sunday Independent, negative equity to end next year. I'd say that'd be a relief to a lot of people who might, I know, are still in negative equity, but there you go. The ESRI says new wealth effect to lead to higher spending. Sunday Independent up at the top as well has ODCE gets complaint on FAI. And apparently there have been two complaints lodged with the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement. The Sunday Business Post leads with a kind of a scary headline for Irish. Draghi blasts government's repossession plan and warns mortgage rates could rise. The ECB chief says moral hazard must be prevented on house repossessions. A new bill has cabinet approval but now faces serious opposition. Fine Gael lobbied European allies to drop tax and EU army plans, and they just have a picture of John Delaney up the top there with Off the Ball is their headline. Now, just before I go to the rest of the Irish ones, I think it's worth noting that on the English papers or the British papers, the Telegraph is running with the headline, Cabinet told to oust May. That's on their front page. The Observer says, as Tory MPs plot May's downfall, her last allies battle for her survival. And in the Sunday Times, British Cabinet coup set to ditch May for emergency premier. And we will get to those later on because clearly they have consequences for us as well. Now, the Irish Mail on Sunday. I was abused by my uncle, Bishop Casey. I'd say this will come as quite a shock to an awful lot of people. She said she was raped as a child. The Mail on Sunday investigation reveals that allegations were made by two more women and have been settled, which I think will take, because when all the horrible stuff came out about child abuse, you would hear people say, well, poor old Bishop Casey was consenting adults, was the kind of view. So that's very shocking. But the man is dead and he can't defend his name. But on the other hand, they have gone through year by year, and the fact that settlements were made through the board. But we'll get to that later. Sunday World lead with a story about the Cookstown tragedy, I guess we'll call it. The Irish Sun, Delaney's shock of Gibraltar. I like that headline. And Spice Girl Mel B apparently had a relationship together. So you can all read that if you want a bit of celebrity gossip. Now, with us in studio this morning, Dave McWilliams, economist, broadcaster and author. Mary Whelan was a diplomat, most recently ambassador to Austria and the Netherlands. John O'Brien, Jean Monnet, professor of European integration in Maynooth. Jean Kelly, partner with Technology Law, LK Shields. And Owen Corrie, editor of Travel Extra. And you are all most welcome indeed to the programme. We're going to start off with the John Delaney story, and I'm going to go to the phones to talk to Eamon Dunphy and Alan Cawley, RTE soccer analyst. Good morning to you both. Eamon, what was your reaction to this story?
Yeah, well, it broke last Sunday, Marion, when the Sunday Times published a story about John Delaney giving the FAI a £100,000 loan in 2017.
Yeah.
Now, John Delaney tried to injunct the Sunday Times. He sought an injunction, a super injunction, in fact. Not only did he want them not to be able to publish the story, but he didn't want them to be able to say that he stopped them. Judge Anthony Barr refused the injunction. So it emerged last Sunday as a story that the chief executive of the FAI had lent the association £100,000 in 2017 and had that money had been repaid 12 months later. It raised the question.
I think it was 2 months later. I could be wrong on that. I think it was 2 months.
I think so. No, I think...
Maybe I'm wrong. Okay.
Yeah, no, it was a year later, in 2018, that the money was, in fact, repaid. So, in itself, I'm not sure... Actually, you're right. It was June 2017. So it was lent for 3 or 4 months. It didn't seem such a big story. I think the big story was that Delaney was prepared to go to such lengths to have
to block it.
To block it. And from there, really, it's been rumbling along all week. It came to a head last night in Gibraltar when John Delaney resigned as chief executive. But he immediately stepped into a role that was created, apparently yesterday, of executive president of the FAI, which allows him to stay in situ, really, and to keep his job with UEFA, which is a powerful job and a lucrative job as well.
Which would matter to him, but would also matter to the FAI, presumably, because he's been kind of successful at handling all those kind of relationships. Alan Cawley, what was your reaction?
Yeah, like Eamon said, Marion, it's been a hugely dramatic few days, in particular, obviously, the fact that John has been there so long. He was obviously... came into the FAI and joined the Board of Management in 1999. He was a treasurer in 2001, and then he was appointed CEO in 2005. And since that time, obviously we're talking 14 years, he's had a major stranglehold on the association. And
well, he was supposed to be running it.
Yeah, well, you would expect him to have that, but it's been a very forceful one in terms of how he's been dealing with everything, obviously. And these stories have emerged last week. Obviously, the one, as Eamon mentioned, was the bridging loan, but there's been more stories that have come out today in the Sunday Times in terms of his rent, and that's coming off the back of the huge salary that he has earned throughout this period of time and the fact that they were also paying $36,000 of his rent. Also, so there's been a lot of discontent towards the organisation, particularly in recent years, I have found, largely off the back of the huge sum of money that I suppose John has been earning, and people asking the questions in terms of the development of the game here, where is it going? Obviously, the League of Ireland is the highest standard of football you can play it here. And if you look at the prize money that's on offer for teams involved in that, it's a paltry sum of money when you consider what the CEO has been earning.
We were interviewing Niall Quinn recently, and it was the first time I kind of fully got it how some of it works, not all of it, but that each one of those clubs pays 19,000 annually for affiliation, and they get 500,000 from schoolboys. So it's quite expensive to be affiliated there.
Absolutely, and if you look at the clubs over the years, like you're talking about the development of the game here, they've been basically just trying to survive. Now, that's not all down to the FAI. Obviously, the clubs have to take responsibility themselves, but as the governing body of the game here, you would expect them to be trying their best in terms of investment and trying to develop the game as best they can. And I suppose what people are looking at this morning is you look at the likes of those clubs who have been struggling and trying to get on. There was also a story back in 2016 coming off the back of the European money, that prize money that obviously Ireland received for qualification at the time, and they came out with a suggestion that they were going to give $5,000 to each and every club. There's 20 clubs obviously with the Premier Division and the First Division, and it was only St. Pat's and Derry City that stood up to them and says this is an absolute disgrace, that's all you're offering in terms of a grant towards the clubs to come up with a 5-year business plan. So there's been a lot of discontent, Marion.
Right.
As I said, this kind of, you see these stories emerging last week and today, and it's probably justified that discontent.
The To go back to you, Eamon, in some ways, 100,000 in the context of a multi-million annual budget, it seems like kind of loose change,
yeah,
you could say. Can you see how that might have arisen?
Well, it's difficult to see how it would have arisen, but it could have been as a result of Dennis O'Brien withdrawing his patronage, if you like, from the association. Over the years since 2008, Dennis O'Brien has given over 12.5 million to the FAI,
yeah,
to bring in Trapattoni,
I remember, yeah,
Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane, and to get the best management teams money can buy, really. And that was a very welcome contribution that Dennis O'Brien made to Irish soccer. That money was withdrawn, and when that was withdrawn, the bills still had to be paid. Dennis, Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill were still on big salaries. So it isn't inconceivable that the FAI had cash flow problems, but you would have thought they could have gone to their bank. They had 25 bank accounts with
them. It's a lot of bank accounts, isn't it? Or maybe not, and that works.
Really. They could have gone to, and said, look, can you lend us 100 grand? So there is a bit of mystery about that, some speculation about how John Delaney would be the one giving the money. I, to be honest, if you look at the big picture here, there isn't an awful lot of corruption and an awful lot of bad behaviour or chicanery that I can see.
Yeah.
What I see is a man who foolishly went looking for an injunction to stop the Sunday Times publishing a story that in itself is pretty harmless.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a wrong thing to do to lend somebody money, you know, to tide them over.
No, I mean, he could have said, okay, they had a cash flow problem, and as chief executive, you know, I stepped in and helped him out. So I think he probably jumped the gun, and the judge.
And now people will be all over the accounts and auditing like a rash.
Yeah. And
I think people were taken aback that his accommodation was paid for.
Yeah.
Now, people say that's unusual in that word, but I was just thinking of a lot of the companies coming into Ireland. I'd be surprised if they didn't give accommodation to some of their staff.
Yes, I mean, again, that's not particularly shocking. Given the money that was coming into the association, I don't think it is particularly shocking. The problem he has now is he has to answer to a Rochtus committee, because one very salient point is the FAI gets about 4 or 5 million a year from the government.
Yes.
And you've got to answer for that. So the Rochtus Committee on Sport are holding hearings, and also the Oireachtas Committee on Transport, Tourism and Sport are holding hearings into the situation with the FAI.
Right.
And one of the problems that does exist there is it's very much a one-man band, and there are issues about corporate governance. The length of time people have been on the board, the lack of rotation around the board and other offices. So in those areas, I think the FAI and John Delaney will have questions to answer. But there isn't any great financial scandal that I can see in this story.
Right.
I think Mario,
yes,
what makes it more eye-catching is the sums of money you're talking about. And you may say that it's not unusual in terms of multinational companies maybe paying for accommodation and stuff.
Yeah.
But if your CEO is earning 360 grand a year and you're still paying his rent at 3 grand a month, and this was at a time, going back to August 2012, when he was asking staff to take pay cuts or face job losses, I think that's fairly eye-catching. When you look at it in the grand scheme of things. Also, as Eamon mentions, you look at the board of management, and when one of John Delaney's biggest decisions, his first big decision really when he took over, was not to renew Brian Kerr's contract. And I suppose the board of members that were on the committee at that time, there was 10 of them that oversaw that decision. You look at 13 years later, and 6 of those officials are still at the top table. So there is certainly kind of a lot of questions in terms of the governance and what's been going on. It's been a closed shop for a long time. You look at the AGMs as well, and it's been kind of farcical in terms of the lack of questioning and transparency that goes on at those. So there is questions certainly to be asked.
Right. They do say in Brisbane that he was a dinger for raising money, and that Aviva in Lansdowne Road will be paid off on time, where after the crash people said not a chance because people didn't buy the expensive tickets.
Is that to me, Marion?
Well, yes, to you, yeah.
I think, you know, Delaney is a guy with a vision. He has a vision for Irish soccer, and the Aviva is part of it. The problem with the project is the crash happened to coincide with this amazing new home for Irish soccer. There was nothing wrong with the vision. It's just the timing was off. The same with the Dennis O'Brien money. That's a lot of money, but it was well used. We brought the best coaches we could get. So he has had a vision. He has spread the gospel of the game around the country. There are things that he has done that have been good. Unfortunately, he didn't have a good relationship with the media. He was contemptuous of them and showed it. And as Alan has pointed out, and other people, the corporate governance of the association has been poor.
OK. Stay with me, if you would, I would say to both of you. Owen, how do you read this?
An empire was built by John Delaney, and he built it, as many politicians and sports people have, by getting their grassroots on side before he moved into the position. As Eamon says, contentious of the media, untouchable. What most fans harp on about, and they've chanted about this at matches, is his enormous salary, which, it has to be said, we are paying too much for the CEO of the FAI.
Well, he negotiated a contract. I mean, presumably he did it in a hard-nosed fashion.
And the credit has to be given that he, for the first time in the history of the FAI, turned it into a money-making organisation. The point Alan made is that the winners of the domestic league, the prize money they get is less than one third of his salary. If you take the salaries of the CEO of the GAA and the IRFU, two eminently successful sporting bodies, and add them together, they don't come to that. So while all of this success was being presented to the Irish fans, there was some international success as well, the Euros 2016, and the bringing of the finances into order, because the FAI historically was a receipts in a shoebox organisation, really right up to the history of when Eamon was started playing. You know, it was bookmakers running Drumcondra, and bookmakers running Shamrock Rovers, and scrap merchants running Drumcondra. It was always
with bookmakers and scrap merchants
passing the parcel round at the pub on Friday night to pay wages. That's where Irish soccer was. So this guy came with, as Eamon says, the vision. He brought them, he tapped into the huge money that's flushing through international soccer. That had changed, by the way, and he was in a position to do that and built this empire. And as it appeared, he was above reproach, he was above the chance of the fans. But by the way, on the salary thing, I don't think the Spanish Soccer Association or the Italian Soccer Association pay the same for their CEO. So he was riding this wave of his own success in tapping into international soccer. He brought the FAI from a situation of penury, shoebox stuff. And at some stage, it was all going to go horribly wrong for him. And when you regard yourself as above the normal laws of corporate governance, which he clearly did,
But sure, after the Genesis report, wasn't that when he brought in the new system and reduced the board and did all those things which they
Genesis
were asked.
Genesis would
to
make
do.
You cry. I mean, a major national soccer organisation, and not only that, but some of Genesis wasn't published for legal reasons. It was so critical of what had gone before.
Okay,
when
John,
you've gone from penury to this. This is, you know, he was the man with the halo, and this is what's largely caused this.
I think Eamon actually understates the seriousness of this. Mm. The allegations against the FAI go back a long way to the early 1990s with the ticket scandal around the 1990-1994 World Cup, Merrion Gate as it was christened, all the things that came out of Genesis in 2005. Remember also when Thierry Henry broke our hearts that night in Paris.
Could we ever forget?
But subsequently we found out that the FAI lobbied FIFA and succeeded in getting a payment of €5 million. It seems to have been completely irregular. FIFA then wrote it off. So there are deep and enduring questions here about governance.
He tried at the time. I'm hazy on the details. He tried at the time to get them to accept an extra team going through. And they kind of treated his request with derision. But if you opened your eyes, Thierry Henry didn't just do it once, he did it twice. And they completely ignored their own rules. So, I mean, John Delaney was going into bat for Irish soccer.
He was, but there is a link here between the FAI and the way they conduct their business and the way FIFA conducted its business under Sepp Blatter. And this is highly irregular patterns, very arbitrary forms of corporate governance.
Well, I mean, we've heard an awful lot about Sepp Blatter, which I presume is not going to go away, you know, because there was a report last week on a substantial sum of money being paid to the World Soccer Organization if the games went to Qatar. I wonder, was there any connection?
Marion,
yes?
Your contributor is dead right, and you said there that they treated it with derision. They were right to, because it was laughable that John Delaney was suggesting that we would become an extra team that time. We all know that Thierry Henry handled the ball, but that was never, ever going to happen. And the contribution of $5 million
at the time... Why is that? Why should that be impossible?
Because that's just the game of football, and that's what happens. Now,
No. Why couldn't there be an extra team?
Because there was never that. I don't think that has ever been the case, and it was never ever going
well,
to be.
Well, there can always be a first time.
Just on the back of a handball in a match. That's just something that happens in every game of football. Sometimes the rules may go with you, they go against you. They went against us massively that night. But we're in a time now with obviously with the video technology that would have been sorted out straight away had it been obviously around at the time, but it wasn't. But for him to suggest that we would become the 33rd team in that tournament was a great idea. I thought it was an absolute laughing stock.
Well, you guys are into it, so you can do the laughing, but I was doing the hoping. Eamon, to split the function now, which seems to be the plan.
Yeah.
Good or bad idea?
Well, it enables John Delaney to survive and to keep his job with UEFA, which is a powerful and well-paid job. And I think that he's moved seamlessly in a matter of 12 hours from being a former chief executive to being an executive president of the association. I think that the Office of Corporate Enforcement will have a question or two to ask about that. How did it happen? Who voted for it? How is it processed?
It is in some of the reports today that it was 2 days ago and there was a unanimous.
Good old John. He's in control. Well, let's see what happens. I'm sure it'll be questioned. And there needs to be change.
Okay. Last word on this to you, Jean.
I know less than nothing about soccer, and I know my family will be listening in to hear me express a view on something I know nothing about, but I do know something about corporate governance, and I think that's my focus on this. And I suppose the questions I would have if I was on the board of the FAI, which is very unlikely to ever happen, is, you know, how that interplay is going to work between the new CEO and this executive vice president.
You need to have it very clear.
Yeah, and what isn't clear from the FAI statement, although perhaps it's clear in the report which they commissioned on this, is, you know, whether the new executive vice president, Mr. Delaney, is going to be involved in the recruitment of the new CEO. There is a little throwaway line, maybe it's very anodyne, it just says that the new chief executive and the executive vice president are going to have to work very closely together in a collaborative manner.
And that, you know, could lead to me.
I think that's going to be interesting.
It's funny you talk about, Owen was talking about the shoebox approach to finance of the FAI. My first job was selling programmes in Lansdowne Road as a schoolboy, okay, at Irish International. And people who watched Irish International in the old days will remember they were played on a Wednesday afternoon because there was no floodlights and you get a half day to go and sell programmes. And this is when the Republic of Ireland weren't a bad side at all. This was in the post-Dunphy, early Chippy Brady days. And I do remember my only, maybe the alarm bells were ringing in my head as a kid, when the mode of delivery of the finance, so we would be given a rake of programmes and you'd stand outside and you'd sell them and you'd have like a cotton bag into which you'd throw all the swag, all the fivers and quids and the whole thing and tenors and the whole thing. And the bag was then delivered to the back door of Slattery's Boozer on Beggar's Bush, and that's how the finances were handled. And we were then given a tenner, the young fellas.
Tenner was
a huge amount, huge amount. We were given a tenner out of the bag. And the bag was then handed in to the hands of members of the FAI. And that's the way the accounts were kept.
Go ahead. Before I come to the match last night, Mary, I didn't go to you at all in this. Do you take a view?
Well, I do have a view. When my employer, the Government of Ireland, had a cash flow problem a few years ago, it cut my salary. I didn't ask me for a loan. I would have been happy to give them a loan and they could have paid me back. So I don't know if it's irregular, but it's unusual. It's a, you know. The second thought I have is I have a grandchild who plays soccer, and you look at all of these volunteers, all of these people playing out there, and you think, are they served by this scandal? When the back room and not the pitch becomes the story, an organisation has a big problem.
Yeah. OK, let me go to soccer now. Eamon, what did you think last night?
Well, it was very difficult circumstances. There was a gale force wind blowing across the pitch. It wasn't very conducive to football. Mick McCarthy said after the match that he hated match, but he loved the 3 points, and I think that's a fair summary. I think it was a good start, a win. And hopefully we win on Tuesday, and that's a good start.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, thank you both very much. That was Eamon Dunphy and Alan Cawley, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Now, caller was on to say that she will have sorted out her equity problem by 2030. So, good luck to you on that. My negative equity mortgage's final payment is in 2031. I will presumably things will have shifted in the meantime. John Delaney, up to recently, the women's soccer team used borrowed kit. That's true, and changed in airports. John Delaney, God, Marion, how nice with that salary to have rent paid that he could not look after himself and buy a home. People coming back to the money all of the time. John Delaney was earning 360 grand a year at a time when the winners of the National League got 100k and the women's soccer couldn't even get a tracksuit. If memory serves me right, they were forced to change in airport hotels and give them back. And just a last one on that. Marion, there are three golden rules of corporate governance. Firstly, when you complete a term as CEO, you leave. This new role will make it impossible for any new CEO. Secondly, you rotate your board on a regular basis, and the FAI board has totally failed in this regard. Thirdly, you need total financial disclosure. The 100k loan was not disclosed, and significant expense was incurred to keep it from the public. Well, I presume eventually it'll come out because these things do. Now, I mentioned that before we go to the dreaded Brexit, I mentioned that headline about Draghi. And there is also the question that our man, so to speak, going to the ECB will have a particular role. But, I mean, Draghi, who, with those little words, whatever it takes, saved all our bacon, really wants us to get our act together. Did you have a look at that, Dave McWilliams?
I had a quick look at it. This is Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, saying basically that Ireland should force more people who are in arrears out of their properties. So accelerate repossessions. Now, obviously, this has been going on for many, many years. The Irish government has taken a much more humane stance on it.
And certainly the courts have.
Yeah, and the courts have. I mean, the courts have taken a much more humane stance on this, and have taken people's circumstances in. Again, I think this is an economic sort of blind spot where somebody like Mario Draghi looks at his economic models and says, look, if you don't do this, it won't be efficient and consequently you will have to pay down the road. This sort of scientific approach.
Yeah.
But the courts are
could
looking...
Could that be true?
The courts are looking... It could be true, but the courts are looking at real people. And real families and real situations. And they're applying a combination, I presume, of law and interpretation. And the interesting thing is, over the course of, let's say, the 15 years we're talking about, where people bought at the height and then it crashed, and now, as you can see in that news story in the Sunday Independent, property prices are coming up, notwithstanding what your caller said there, because that's average prices. So certain people bought really at the height, and those plumbed to real depths, and they're still... So my feeling is that Draghi yet again reinforces why economists need their hands held by real people. And that repossessions are very, very deep. The histories of the country, the history of this country with respect to...
Are we going through eating bread soon forgotten? I mean, if he hadn't done what he did...
Well, they're two different things. So Draghi did, basically you had a fellow called Trichet, who was a French functionaire, had got to the very top of the central banking world, and the pinnacle of that in Europe is obviously to become the chief bottle washer in the ECB.
Yeah.
And he became that, and he had a very dirigiste, I would say French view, of the world, which was that there is inflation around the corner all the time and the central bank must be so strong. So when the euro came under massive, massive pressure, people were saying, do what the Americans did, rip up the rule book, buy all the bonds of countries and ease the pressure. And he said, no, we can't do this. We've never done it before and it's not in the rule book.
Just like getting an extra team into the
world. Just like getting an extra team into the world. Draghi comes in using his John Delaney approach and says, you know what, I have an extra team for you. So Draghi comes in, he's Italian, the Italians have been dealing... A lot of this stuff is cultural.
Yeah.
The Italians have been dealing for years with this chicken, kind of game of chicken between the government and the central bank and who's going to finance the country. Anyway, he said, hold on a second, if we go down this very perfect economic rules agenda, the euro...
We'll crash.
So what we're going to do is we're going to tear up the rule books and we're going to now buy up everything, ease the pressure, print money. I know it hasn't been done before, but that's what the Americans are doing at the moment. And you know what? We'll try and do it.
And at the end of the day,
it worked. Yeah. And again, it's a difference between the French functionaire, really, really rules-based, the Italian guy coming in saying, let's do things differently. Interestingly now, in terms of Philip Lane, who is the former or outgoing central bank governor, has got the job of chief economist in the ECB.
And that's a very
big job. You know, I was just thinking you're talking football. It's a bit like a fella from Lourdes Celtic ending up captaining Real Madrid, OK? People who know where Lourdes Celtic football team is, it's a huge job for Irish economics. I think everybody who's in the field is really... I did think this morning, this is a really impressive coup for Philip Lane. He's a very, very nice guy. He's incredibly clever. He's a brilliant, brilliant academic. He has, as the head of the central bank in a difficult time, even though he hasn't been in the job particularly long, he's done a pretty good job. And I think it's something that sometimes when one of your own gets a big gig, you kind of discount it. But I think this is a really... I think it's very good. However, I think if Irish people think that he will fly the flag for Ireland and go to UEFA and say, can we have an extra team? Okay. I don't think that's what he will do. His job is
to prevent the Japanification of Europe. Just very briefly.
I'll explain that to you. The Japanification.
And the need for inflation. And why should there be need for inflation?
So the Japanification is a term that economists use about what happened to Japan between 1990 and now. And what happened to Japan between 1990 and now is they had a massive boom and it crashed. And then Japan went into what they would call this sort of 20-year decline that incomes continue to fall all the time. And again, it's largely based on two things, one of which is demographics. The Japanese are getting older, and older countries don't grow very quickly because older people don't spend as much. This is, it's kind of not that, that difficult to figure out. And the second thing is that Japanese industry migrated to China. So a lot of Japanese industry, you know, your big Toshibas and Sanyos and Sonys and all those, migrated to China and Korea. So the idea is that Lane has a job to do, which is to ensure that the European economy, which is now faltering quite quickly, in fact, Germany had figures yesterday which were very, very weak, that the European economy is supported by the ECB, i.e. keeping interest rates, Marion, down as close to zero as you can.
Yeah.
And that, I think, will be a massive job for him. The other problem with respect to inflation is that everybody, myself included, Philip included, of a certain generation, were schooled, and I'm a former central banker, were schooled to the idea that inflation is the big enemy. But now deflation in Europe is the big enemy, which is actually prices falling, not rising, and falling too quickly. Now, the question is, if deflation is the enemy, inflation is the solution. That means you have to keep interest rates...
A little.
Exactly. And the thing about inflation, if it keeps going up a little bit, it makes debts much easier to pay. It increases wages a little bit. People feel a little bit better about themselves. So the idea would be that Philip Lane's job as the chief economist, and he will be making policy, is to ensure that deflation in Europe doesn't become the norm. A little bit of inflation becomes the norm. And that will demand extraordinarily deft management of interest rates.
Yeah.
So it's, I think it's a really big gig, and I think that anybody who knows him, it's a, for himself personally, it's a wonderful opportunity. But I think for, you know, economics in this country, it's really interesting if somebody begins to take up the reins of what is a massive economics job.
Right, Mary.
I think the Draghi story is interesting because I think that the issue of who pays for our forbearance hasn't really been addressed here at all. And there is somebody paying. There are lots of people paying. And of course, we have to...
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in the sense that our banks are carrying a lot of bad debt.
Yeah.
They're also trying to deal with the tracker problem, whereby some people have quite low interest rates and other people have to pay higher interest rates on their mortgage because of that mistake that the banks made. But all of this is going to impact on mortgage holders in the future. They're going to be paying higher mortgage rates. Part of the reason they'll pay higher mortgage rates is to help the banks to recover. And secondly, because competition in this market is very, very lacking. Mm-hmm. And competition is lacking because you can't get new people to come in, new lenders to come in, for the simple reason that collateral is not good in this, property collateral isn't good. So there is a huge problem. We have, to a large extent, kicked the can down the road. We have let the courts deal with the issue, but not deal with the issue. And sooner or later, it has to be dealt with. Now, whether that is more forgiveness, more forbearance, but there has to be something, because I think that future mortgage holders, maybe you disagree with me, David, or present mortgage holders are partly paying for this problem.
Well, the rates are higher than they are in Europe.
They are higher. I think that in a crisis, the thing you really run out of is time. We happen to run out of time and money, right? But you run out of time. And in economics, the economic cycle solves a lot of things. If you can actually...
Give it time.
Yeah, you can give it time. And I think the story of Ireland in the last 10 years is that a lot of things have been sorted out just by the progression of weeks and months. What is unusual in the headline of the Sunday Independent today, and this is a problem, and this comes back to your point, Mary, is that the problem, that what they're saying is negative equity is lifted, there will be a wealth effect, and this will cause the economy to grow.
Right.
And this, I think, is a problem, because what it's saying is that houses are always an asset, but never accommodation. And as long as we look at houses, and it's marketed by...
Property.
What you get is this extraordinary situation that when you own a house, if you think it's an asset, you want house prices to rise. When you don't own a house, you want them to fall. And if you didn't own a house and wanted them to fall, then you buy a house, you want them to rise. So it splits the country totally between house owners and non-house owners. And I think that
the one thing we haven't learned
is that housing is accommodation. It's accommodation. It's a place to live. It's not an asset.
John, you wanted to come in there.
I think the big problem here, to go back to the first thing that David said, is about the reigning philosophy and culture within the European Central Bank. It is very rigid. It's very one-dimensional, based on what some economists call German ordo-liberalism, the idea that the only way you can get out of trouble is to impose austerity. And you do. It's highly differential, of course, in its effects. And I think that's one of the big issues that the European Union just hasn't dealt with or hasn't dealt with effectively. I think Draghi is wrong about this. Ours is not just an economy, it is a society. And I think the problem with the ECB, it's a highly insulated institution. There are good reasons that courts and central banks are insulated from the normal kind of checks and balances and so on. But I think the ECB sits at an extreme. It is virtually unaccountable in the way that it operates. And nothing has changed in the course of the crisis. And my big fear is that, you know, emanating from things in the United States and elsewhere, we're going to find a repeat of 2008. It won't repeat itself in the same way.
If you look at Italy,
we are really badly placed to deal with that right across the EU, partly for these reasons.
You know, I mean, there's a fear in Europe that, you know, Britain exiting and with whatever deal, but exiting. And they're afraid the contagion will spread. And I know you're very pro-Europe and involved in it, but it seems to me that at the heart of Europe, they never say, I wonder why they want to get out. Like, why are we afraid there would be a queue of people trying to get out? There must be a reason. And every time you talk to really serious Europhiles, they look at you as if you're using bad language.
No, there is a big problem. You can see it in France in the Gilets Jaunes protests. And I've been in Brussels for the last week. There is enormous complacency, in my view, amongst people on both the centre-right and the centre-left about what's going on. There's a tendency to dismiss the protests in France, to reduce it just to the extremes of people smashing up shops, Champs-Élysées. That's real, it's there. But there's also something else.
There's Marine Le Pen.
It's what's been driving Brexit, what's been driving the Trump vote. It is austerity over a 10, 15, and maybe even a 20-year period about all kinds of other things connected to globalisation that are having real impacts in real communities. And there's a sense that the EU just doesn't have the right tools or the capacity to deal with these effectively.
Jean? I suppose I think on the other side of that, I think there's been a marked, you know, I think there's a sadness out there in relation to people's reluctance to speak with great affection about the European Union and what it's brought. And I think that's maybe the balancing that Brexit has brought to the conversation, is that people are now quite proud to speak of their affection for the union. I mean, as a professional working woman, I know we have come closer to equal pay for women than would ever have been possible without the European Union. But my generation were very quiet about that until Brexit. You know, certainly looking at the footage last night of the march in London, you know, seeing people waving flags and people being very pro-European, pretty centrist people, to be honest, being publicly pro-European, is something that's new for us.
Brexit has been the single biggest shot in the arm for the European Union institutions in the last 40 years. And that is a massive, massive fact that's kind of overlooked, that because Brexit has focused on what nationalism looks like, what it smells like and what it feels like.
But it's on the grow. It's growing. I mean, you were recently in the Netherlands, and you see what's happening there, what's happening in Austria, what's happening on the Eastern European countries. Like, all that idealism that you're talking about, and indeed Jean Monnet's idealism, seems to have gone out the window.
But there's two separate things. Of course the EU is not perfect, but that doesn't mean we're going to throw it out with the bathwater. And I think that part of what Brexit has shown us is that it permeates all aspects of our life and how difficult it is to separate. And it does bring that to the fore in a very strong sense. But also what it shows us is what the meaning of solidarity is. Now, I think some people, and I think this was the narrative in Britain for a long time, that solidarity in the EU meant somebody else's hand in your pocket and that they were paying for you know, other people.
Yeah, well, they were paying big money.
Yeah, okay. But solidarity for us right now is, despite people's self-interest maybe not always being quite the same as ours in this particular debate, they have stood with us resolutely. And the story on the BBC the other night was when they were trying to sort out the timing for the extension of Article 50. Oh, they are at long last, the divisions are appearing. The divisions were about how nice can we be to the UK, not between the 27.
OK, can I come to you, Owen?
I think we got to weigh this up and say there's one country leaving the European Union, wanting to leave. There are a lot of countries still want to join. There are countries that, who is where the negotiations have broke down, but would love to join. Of course, as we heard, there is this sense of a distance from the elite and the being marginalised and forgotten. It's emerging all over Europe. It was always there. It's hit us with big elections in Philippines and Brazil and America and with the Brexit vote. And John's right, the elite in Brussels probably haven't identified that and start tackling it.
Well, I think the other places regard them as unruly peasants as opposed to adult people, all of that.
Yeah, it's the same. It is all. But is the institution or is the European Union crumbling? I think we're very, very far away from that. And
do you? Because, I mean, at the moment, if you look at Italy, if you look at what Greece went through, if you look at Romania, if you look at the rise of the right in Austria and the Netherlands, are you sure?
Romania is the president of the European Union.
They're really working.
Italy has a budgetary conflict. Greece has this sense of grievance. All of these things are normal in a large working body of 27 countries, which the European Union is. I think back to Draghi's comments, two of the points he made are extremely local to us. One of them is the clogging up of the court system. If every borrower's personal circumstances, and there's a lot of people in negative equity, is now central and relevant, as our government would claim, and the court system themselves independently are doing, that will remain, that will create a backlog. But the other point, which nobody else has mentioned, is the banks are still in control. They are the ones who will argue that this will compromise their facility to lend money.
Yeah.
And the people who...
And Draghi referred to it as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's in Draghi's points. And the people who hectored is into borrowing too much money and then left us with the bill to pay are still in control. And I don't see any way round. I don't see any movement from Europe to try and shift that power balance. It was very, very well discussed in the early days of the recession. But what you do when you're travelling around the world, you see other countries who tackled that, who whistled past it. The Americans were in as deep a recession, pulled through it quicker because they weren't as rules-based. And the Australians seem to have whistled right through. I mean, they were sitting on commodities, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did things like... freed spending. They gave small grants to households to spend more to get over the little speed bumps along the way while we were tied into this very rule-based approach to it. Yeah. And the most relevant for me point from Draghi is that the ability of the banks to turn off credit facilities and on like a tap is still central to, the government is pretty powerless, right. Europe is pretty powerless, it's pretty central to the societal problem this has brought.
I'll come to you in a second, John. If you take what Draghi said, if we make up all this makey-uppy money, there have to be consequences at some stage. And there's borrowing universally that is kind of eye-watering. But his point about the banks, and indeed... Owen's point about that. How safe are our banks, do you think? Now, I mean, people are accustomed, I'm sorry to all bankers before I say that, they don't believe them. They think that they lied to us in the past, which would give us rise to believe they might lie to us again.
Well, the interesting thing is, the first part of your question is about this makey-uppy money. One of the weird things, Marion, which is why central banks are such crucial institutions, is they can make up the money. This is what people think.
Pretend, though.
There's a real sense that in some way there's going to be long-term consequences, there's going to be catastrophes, etc. In fact, the last 10 years, what has actually happened is the reason the central banks are important is they print the stuff. And they print stuff that has no intrinsic value, and because of our belief that it has intrinsic value, it suddenly has value. So that's a very strange bit of economic alchemy.
So we pretend it has value.
Well, this is the real interesting thing about money. It is an unusual leap of faith on the part of individuals to think that I'm going to give you a piece of paper and you're going to say, geez, that's worth a tenner. And that can buy this and this and this. So this is one of the very strange things about monetary economics. Second thing is there's a big move now in economics to suggest that printing money doesn't matter. Okay? It's called New Monetary Theory. It's very much backed by Bernie Sanders in the States, by AOC in the States. This idea that if you could do, you remember that thing QE, if you could print all the money and nothing happened, and you could give it all to the bankers and it saved the banks, why don't you build bridges and schools and...
Spread it around.
With the same idea. So if you can give all the money to the banks and nothing happened, okay, in terms of there's no long-term impossible or negative consequence, why not do it properly and build... And this is very interesting. This is, again, economics, like everything, mutates with events.
Right.
Okay.
How solid are our banks now?
I think now the banks are pretty much not the problem in the economy. Do you know what I mean? If you look around the
but
economy...
But if we hit another speed bump, okay, or if we hit another black swan...
If interest rates went up, let's say, for example, if interest rates went up dramatically, okay, and then you get another housing crisis because lots and lots of people, like your caller, and most of us here, have mortgages and they're still pretty hefty, okay? If that went up, it's very, very clear the banking system would be straight back
supposing
into a problem.
Supposing something happens in another country that we hadn't anticipated, say, like... Italy, they're always given out about the euro. They want their lira back so that they can devalue and revalue and devalue.
Look, I think one of the lessons that all of us have from the last 10 years or 15 years is that the innate fragility of the global economy and the innate fragility of the economic status quo. And this is what always makes me nervous when governments and politicians invest so much time in the now, saying, we have done this, we have done, you know, the Tom, Dick and Harry, right? That in actual fact, because of globalization, because of lots and lots of borrowing, the global economy is unbelievably fragile to unforeseen events, these black swan events.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could come from a default in China, for example, which is heavily leveraged. It could come from a problem with the United States. So, again, my base position is never think anything's permanent.
Okay, very quickly now, John, I'm sorry to do this.
Just to be clear on Europe, I don't think the European Union's survival is in any way in question. David's right that Brexit has been fantastically sobering and chastening, reminding people what the structure is there for. But the elections at the end of May, I think, will give us a real barometer of where the EU stands in people's affections.
Yeah.
And my worry is that we're going to see another reduced turnout on about 40%. In some countries, it'll be less than 20%. And we will definitely see in the next parliament a vastly increased number of people from the far right who, at the very least, can block legislation for the five years that follow.
OK, I'll come to you after the break, but I have to take the break. For coming up to 12 o'clock.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And thank you very, very much indeed. Now, just a couple of comments from before 12 o'clock. In Ireland, the biggest residual issue is negative equity. Not only are we not repossessing, which is fair enough, we're actively preventing people in negative equity from voluntarily surrendering or selling the house and starting again. We need to allow and indeed encourage voluntary surrender in return for debt. Right, Dan? Another one says, Draghi's actions mean that the value of savings of prudent people has diminished. We've been asked to pay again and again for the defaulters. Marion, Ireland has very few evictions compared with any other developed country. The result is that good, hard-working house owners are paying 2% extra on their mortgages. This amounts to billions of euro per year, which has to be paid to banks to keep those who can't pay, but also those who won't pay in their home. And indeed, Mr. Draghi mentioned moral hazard. Anyway, let us move on for the moment. A hotel in Rooski made the headlines in recent months after two arson attacks. It's the Shannon Key West Hotel. It was to be opened as an accommodation centre for asylum seekers, but it was confirmed this week by the Department of Justice and Equality that it's not in a position to proceed with plans to open the accommodation centre because of, quote, difficulties with the lease agreement. Patsy McGarry, religious correspondent, religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times, joins me now. Patsy, you're from Ballyhadrin, which is not too far from Rooski, but you like to make those definitions very clear about
borders. We're at the other
borders.
End of the
county. You have a hard border between
55 kilometres.
How did you react to what happened? Because Badreen got all sorts of praise and awards and everything for how they handled it, but they didn't want it in the first place.
Well, when it was announced in 2017 and it was a fait accompli, there was a lot of nervousness in the town as to what this would mean. The town already has approximately 200 Pakistanis living there out of a population of about 2,000. Above all, the hotel that was to be used for the EROC Centre, this is the Emergency Reception Orientation Centre, people locally were building tourism plans around it reopening. And when it was taken over by this Cork consortium, that was believed was going to happen. It didn't happen. And there was grave disappointment about that. And really, the feeling was more disappointment about that than about the Syrians, etc., arriving in the town. And to be very, very fair, and I'm very proud to be able to say this, the people of the town rose magnificently to, first of all, in preparations for the Syrians to arrive, a young group, a Farroiga group, prepared a wall of welcome, which is a very unusual concept in these times, and they got an award for that. And then when they did arrive, the local GA club, soccer club, cricket club went out of their way to help these kids, bring them along to try and make them feel at home as much as possible. So, and they got then last April.
Why did that happen? There was one woman in particular that you drew attention to.
The magnificent Mary Galler, who was interviewed on TV and radio and came out with that terrific line, how could we say no? And she was talking in the context of this young boy that was found on a Greek beach in 2015.
We'll
Aaron
never
Curdy,
forget the image, yeah.
And Mary brought up that image, and of course that resonated with everybody at home in Ballyhadrin itself. And I mean, that set the thing in the tone for the thing. A Syrian journalist here, Razan Ibrahim, went down to Ballyhadrin, met Mary, went around the town and met the local people and wrote what she called a love letter to the people of Ballyhadrin. And of course, last April, they got the Community of the Year Award in the Rehab Awards. All hugely deserved, but it hasn't ended there. I mean, last night, a week ago, on the 16th of March, the GAA hosted a cultural night, Irish traditional music and Syrian traditional music in the town itself. And in the St. Patrick's Day parade last week, they took part too.
The standard fears that you hear articulated about doctors and school places?
All very valid. I mean, Ballyhadrin has two doctors, and the great fear was that the doctors would not be able to cope. And that was a valid fear. There was also a fear that there was only one primary school in the town and that it wouldn't be able to cope either. And it seems initially that the plans of the department were to send those kids to the local primary school, which have created all sorts of difficulties because the kids didn't have English. So there was a separate system put in place to teach English to the kids in the EROC Centre. And it should be pointed out, by the way, there is a difference between these type of centres and what was planned for Rooski. EROC, there was only three of them set up in Ireland, and they were in response to the Libyan stroke Syrian crisis, people drowning in the Mediterranean. In 2015, actually, there was a march organised to commemorate those 1,500 people who were frog marched from Strokestown to Dublin by the bailiffs and put on ships as it happened, Gros Eve in Canada, half of whom, 700. Died. And actually, on the Sunday it started, 700 people were drowned in the Mediterranean. And that was the context in which these...
A connection,
Yes. And it was highlighted by her own experience in the famine. Mary Gallagher was aware of that. Enda Kenny was aware of that and drew attention to it at the time as Taoiseach. So all that fed into the EROC type situation.
So bring me to Rooski.
Rooski is different because it's a direct provision centre. And these go back further to the late 90s here in Ireland, and they are about people who are applying for asylum. People who came into Ballyhadrin had refugee status. They could live and work, they can live and work. And it's only a temporary situation, a clearance house, if you like, for them till they're housed elsewhere. And in fact, most of them have been housed, about two-thirds. And of course, there's a flow-through continuously. Rooski, there are people looking for citizenship, and they go through that torturous process that could take, it takes an average of about 23 months now. There are 38 of these centres in 17 counties throughout Ireland. There's one not too far from Rooski in Longford, so people in Rooski will be familiar with the tardy process involved, the 74 people there in Longford itself. Most incredibly, there's 500 in Ballyhaunas, it goes back to one of the oldest.
Ballyhaunas has absorbed all sorts of cultures because of the meat plants.
And the same as Ballyhadrin, because that's how the Pakistani population came to Ballyhadrin, because the Sharifiq opened the halal factory in Ballyhaunas in the 1970s, the first purpose-built mosque in Ireland is in Ballyhaunis. And then he opened a second.
So bring me to Rooski.
Well, come back to Rooski, if you insist. clearly, people, it's a small village of about 600 people, and there are 80 people planned for that hotel. And of course, there's no public transport system. There is in Ballyhadrin. There's no train either through Rooski. There's none in Ballyhadrin, by the way, either. But so there were genuine concerns about this very large population into a small community. And I can understand
that. Well, 82 is that large?
80 out of 600. There were concerns about support systems, about education, about schools, about medical care, etc. All of that. Now, I have to add as well, that always in these instances, it happened in Listowel Environ in 2018 as well, you have people raising these same concerns, and you do have to wonder whether they're being used as a vehicle that says, keep them out, we don't want them, and there's a hint of racism there.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a woman who came on at a protest in Rooski and said, we are not racist in Rooski, and I don't believe the people in Rooski are racist. One of my oldest friends is from there, and there isn't a racist bone in his body. And I'll hold you to that, you owe me a pint. it was played upon and successfully. And I mean, when the announcement was made about the Syrians coming to Ballyhadrin, there were leaflets circulated in the town, not by people in the town, but by outsiders who didn't want them coming into the town. People who are driven by just exploiting the situation for their own narrow racist purposes.
Yeah, and afraid of, you know, the foreigner coming in. I mean, there was a lot of criticism.
Can
for
I just
the
say
department.
One thing, one more thing, Marion? The our direct provision system has been a disgrace. I mean, there are people in it at the moment, about 300 who have been in there for 5 years. My colleague, Sorka Pollock, had a piece in the paper on Friday, a family who are now living in Athlone who have been in it for 12 years. Enforced incarceration. Until last year, they weren't allowed to work. Now they are in very restricted circumstances. They get €20 something a week. In some instances, they can't even cook for themselves. So, I mean, the classic simple solution to it is to speed up the process. I mean, it says it takes about 2 years now, but I think on the other end, if people are within that system for a certain period of time, they should get automatic citizenship.
That has been suggested. Yeah. Mary, you wanted to come in there?
Hi, Jean.
I'm
50% Roscommon, and so it's a part of the world I'm familiar with.
You can play for the county.
My father's from a beautiful little village called Tarmanbarry, which I'm going to describe as a suburb of Rooski now, just to wind him up while
it's
listening
on the right
to the radio.
Side of the Shannon,
on the right, absolutely, on the right side of the Shannon fields that ran right down to the Shannon. And I certainly personally got kind of cross during the week when I saw people using the word Rooski as a kind of synonym for NIMBYism and racism. They're very welcoming people.
Well, two arson attacks are not to be dismissed.
No, for sure. But I think a lot of the protest that was involved down there was genuinely in relation to facilities. And I spoke to a friend of mine yesterday who works in the refugee law space, and she talked about one of these direct provision centres in another part of the country where it's, you know, 14 miles outside the nearest town. I mean, I can live 14 miles outside of town because, I have a car and I have family and I have deep connections to a place. If you come from Sudan and you come from a war zone or something and you come in, you don't have those kind of resources. So it genuinely isn't a racism thing. And I agree with what Patsy said. You know, there's people who come in and who kind of take over these kind of situations and who kind of do a bit of racist stirring.
Can I just make a point there?
There's genuine concerns there about the resources that people do need. And direct provision is an absolute national disgrace. It is.
Well,
it
I have
be,
to say that the dreariest places and the saddest places that I've ever been, though I think they have improved a tad.
It's important to make the point, and Jean, I'm sure, will agree, that it is believed that the two arson attacks were not had nothing to do with local people. They were outside. They believe that it was outsiders that were responsible.
Well, was anybody ever charged?
Not yet. The guards are investigating.
That's your point, isn't
no,
it?
No, that's very much my point. I think it's, first and foremost, this was a crime. Whether it was two crimes or three crimes, I don't know, but it was least attempted arson or arson, incitement to hatred, perhaps. It's a lot of different crimes, and I think it should be dealt with like that. And I think these people should be brought to justice. We should know who they are. And I quite accept that they're unlikely to be from the area. But we're lucky in Ireland that we haven't had what has happened in other places, but it could happen here. And we have to deal with it and nip it in the bud. And I think part of that is bringing these people to justice. I also was very struck today when I was looking through the papers, and this issue I knew might come up, and there was a headline which was "Village Under Stress." So I thought, "Oh, it's Rooski, and it's Donnybrook." And I'm thinking, why don't we have a direct provision in Donnybrook on some of the RTE lands? And I can understand if you're in a small village, you know, and if you're not consulted with properly, you are wondering what
but,
is.
But I wonder about the consultation, and I've wondered about it right through from County Clare to Ballyhadrine to where they didn't do consultations, possibly because they figured that if they raised the question of consultation, it would be no way, Jose.
I think that that is a very valid point. You are supplying a platform for the naysayers, and they're always the loudest voice.
Yeah.
And not the instinctive decency of the local people, and they would take over. And I think that, and I wrote at the time that the government wasn't right when it came to Ballyhadrine. They were right, rather, not to have a consultation.
And I think there's a really interesting point of contrast with, not to bring everything back to Brexit, but it all goes back to Brexit. If you look at the resources that the state put into making our passport office, you know, really efficient to a degree, there's actually a level of national pride at how quickly we turn our passport applications. And we have 820,000 new Irish passports issued last year, something like 2,000 or 2,500 asylum applications. Now, there is a country mile of difference between the complexity of the processes. Oh, I'm not saying they're the same.
The sad thing about the mishandling of this, and the direct provision is the most obvious example of it, probably the degree of consultation and giving too much platform to the naysayers, maybe giving more of a background culture to acceptance of it, is we're doing so little in the context of international, what is happening with refugees internationally. Countries I travel to, Kenya has nearly 2 million of them in from Somalia. Turkey will have 3 million. We're talking about tens of thousands. We're not even at the level that the Scandinavian countries are, which is what we should be aspiring to. If we should be getting this right at the very basic level with the small number we have, and building up to more, because we really need to do more. People are still drowning in the Mediterranean.
We're world class at speaking out of both sides of our mouth on this. The number of asylum applications in Ireland has actually dropped dramatically over the last decade. There shouldn't be a problem. The system of direct provision is an absolute disgrace. And I think the Department of Justice decision here is attributed to legal difficulties. They're not quite specified what those are.
Well, I was reading the background, there are complex issues as well.
The optics of it are terrible because it looks like the department has given in to racism.
Yeah.
But that is not the case, to be very fair to the department. In this case, there have been ongoing wranglings going on between the owner of the hotel and the lessee of the hotel, and it hasn't been resolved.
I think that in terms of direct provision now, I think we should entertain an amnesty for people who have been a certain amount of time in these direct provision and just deal with it. Right. The second thing is that Ireland has a higher percentage of immigrants now than Britain has. We don't seem to realise that. 18% of the population here were not born in this country, and 16% in Britain. And immigration, or even moving from the country to the city, whatever, is an act of personal transformation. When people get up in the morning and say, I'm going to move, what they're saying is, I'm going to change me, I'm going to change my circumstances, and I'm going to believe in a better future for me and my kids. And what we see in Ireland with immigration is the immigrants have contributed enormously to this country and will continue. And it strikes me that direct provision allows a tiny minority, but maybe a significant minority, who are afraid of the other and the foreign, to be more and more vocal. If you gave an amnesty to people in direct provision, the economy suggests right now that these people would act, that act of personal transformation would kick in, they'd get jobs, get themselves together, they do a Ballyhadrine on it. And we need to understand that we now are a very mixed society with big immigration, and it has worked.
Well, somebody was talking to me yesterday about Germany and Merkel's big decision and so on. But that when those, I think it was a million came, that the preparations were unbelievable. Within a fortnight, everybody was sorted out with German lessons. Accommodation had been laid on. Consideration had been... But she was getting some of the best educated people in the Middle East into her society as well as her economy.
The Syrians are the best educated people in the Middle East. And the people who have moved in Syria en masse have been urban Syrians. And they have also been the best educated of the best educated. So Germany has done, but again, she's taken big flak for it too.
She sure has, yes, Patsy.
David made the point about 18% of our population being immigrants. Let's look at it the other way. 17% of our own people have immigrated, over 15.
We
have the highest number of immigrants, as in leaving the country, of any country in the developed world. I mean, and we're an immigrant people ourselves. We should understand immigration. Yeah. And we should understand from our history.
This is the point of personal transformation. You transform yourself. You say, I'm going to be a different person. Yeah.
Do you think it is to do that if somebody doesn't look foreign, i.e. colour?
Eastern European,
grand. But somebody of a different colour, not so grand.
I don't think, ordinary day-to-day life in Ireland, I don't think there's been a problem with
that. But there are really dangerous currents circulating on the internet, Facebook groups, on YouTube channels, and all of them are seeking to propagate hate in one shape or another. And this is a real challenge, I think, for the state, not just in the context of places like Ruski, as Patsy has said, but standing back from this for our society, I think that if we look at 2030, if we jump 12 years ahead, we should be planning for 25% of our population having been born elsewhere. We have to think about that, and we have to think about what integration actually means.
The other thing is, when one travels and, as they say, go out foreign, one of the things that's terrific is to go into cities that have people in it from all over the world. It gives a special vibe. And yet we seem to be afraid of that.
Everybody around this table grew up in a very homogenous Ireland where it was sort of, your exposure to culture was pretty limited. It is a joy to go into these great multicultural cities of Europe and places like Brussels with their huge African populations, and everybody in the city celebrates it. Even the people who sometimes march against immigration can be found at the market buying the... one of the truisms since the Second World War is that immigration enriches the country that people move to, and it brings talent, it also brings entrepreneurship. And parts of rural Ireland have seen a century of decline, you know, inability to stay, to field GA teams, things like that. And in some of them, they've been saved by the existing immigration. Now, the existing immigration is not from Syria. The existing immigration is Germans and French and people like that who decide to retire. And you can see schools in West Kerry, in the Gaeltacht regions in West Kerry, where people are speaking in Irish. Irish is their working language, but their surnames are from a mix of Western European countries, it tends to be. Immigration is good. And that message cannot be reinforced early and often enough.
Right. Last word. Yes.
Yeah, can I just come in there? I agree with everything that you've said, but we aren't really different from other people. And if you look at the rise of populism around Europe, if you look at France, if you look at Belgium, if you look at the Netherlands, if you look at Austria, if you look at even the Scandinavian countries, there, and if you look at Brexit, there is a huge pushback. And what I'm saying is, it can happen here. We have to be on top of it. And we have to assume that it could happen. And what are we going to do to stop it happening?
And thankfully, Mary, we don't have a single political party sending out those messages. But you're absolutely right. Be vigilant.
Okay. Okay. On that note, we are going to take a break. Back after this.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marian Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, where even the little things make all the difference. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, I mentioned those headlines in the British press, and of course, much more than the headlines, saying that the cabinet was told to oust May. Tory MPs plot May's downfall. Our last allies battle for her survival. I don't know how many allies she has. And in the Sunday Times, British cabinet coup set to ditch May for emergency premier, whatever that is. Now, since we were on air, Philip Hammond has accused MPs, allegedly trying to oust the Prime Minister, of being self-indulgent, amid reports that his cabinet colleagues are plotting a coup to get rid of her. The Chancellor said replacing Theresa May would not solve the problem, despite heavy criticism of her handling of the Brexit process. To be talking about changing the players on the board, frankly, is self-indulgent. Well, it also may be somewhat inevitable. John, what do you think?
Well, it's been another gobsmacking week, I think, in Brexit land. Lots of moving parts, both in London, in Brussels and national capitals. Very difficult to keep an eye on all of them. But I think what we're seeing is a political crisis that began on the 25th of November last year, when May finally agreed her deal, as it's sometimes mislabeled, with the European Union. So it's a crisis of constitutional authority.
Did it not start when she produced her red lines.
You could argue. I would go back to the Lancaster House speech, certainly in January 2017, that was important. But it's about constitutional authority, the locus of decision-making. It's a crisis in the relationship between the executive and the legislature. Legislature can't seem to make a decision. And in her television address on Wednesday night, she made the situation
far worse.
It was
quite extraordinary.
Because she tried to pit the people... And the people, the British people are divided, as we know. She was presenting the people as unified against these dastardly members of Parliament. She didn't quite call them enemies of the people or saboteurs or any of the other awful language that's been used previously. But it has been dreadful. But what I think we saw this week was, number one, the European Union sought to take control both of the time frame and also of just the kind of modalities through which Brexit would happen. And this week, I think we're going to see, beginning tomorrow, the House of Commons really asserting itself, and probably on Wednesday, through indicative votes of different
kinds. That is, that you put forward a series of propositions.
A series of options, exactly, so that the House might come to a decision finally, God love us, on what the United Kingdom actually wants. But a lot could happen between now and Wednesday. The hope is, I think, that finally the House of Commons would be able to agree or converge around some form of Brexit they go back to the European Union with. Obviously, there's a statutory instrument that will have to be passed this week, possibly tomorrow, as early as tomorrow, in order to avoid the cliff edge at the end of the week. And it's still unclear, next Friday.
I mean, it's hard to believe. You would kind of thought it would never come, and the train is just coming, hurtling at us.
But in effect, the new cliff edge is actually the 12th of April. I mean, that's what the European Council laid down on Thursday.
That's not that far away either.
It's not that far away, but it gives vital breathing space, I think, to those in Parliament who want to see a change. But the other important thing that's going on, I think, is this public momentum behind either revoking Article 50 or a second referendum. Million people marched in London yesterday. More than four million people have signed this petition. I think that will be important in the days to come.
Yeah, if they extend Article 50, would the UK then have to go through European elections? There'd be civil war if they had to.
They will. And that is going to present enormous complications because firstly, it's going to be very polarised in the UK.
Absolutely.
Farage and his like are going to stand and they're going to win a lot of seats and they're going to be even more of a wrecking force. It's also problematic because we don't know if the UK elects MEPs, how long they would actually stay in the Parliament for. And that's important because they would have an input into the appointment of the next European Commission President of the Commission, the President of the Council,
and so on. Corbyn has suggested, and everybody's always rubbishing Corbyn, of the customs union, that would solve our problem. Yes, Mary.
Well, first of all, if you look at the Telegraph today, the first question to ask is, will Theresa May be Prime Minister next week? There isn't one article there that's supporting her. It's the whole paper is.
But they've taken that line from. We know.
Not even one. And there is a general sense where her authority is just non-existent anymore. Now, if the idea of a customs union is voted through, what happens then? And it's voted through before the 12th of April. You still need an executive to go to Brussels and to negotiate how exactly the transition period is going to work. Are they then going to vote through the withdrawal agreement, but with a beefed up political declaration, which says the purpose of this transition period is to negotiate a customs union? I mean, you still need an executive. And who's going to lead that executive?
Who do you think is going to lead it?
I cannot imagine. I do think they have a constitutional crisis. I don't know who has the authority. And in many ways, the problem all along has been... Maybe Boris, but he won't last. He's wildly popular. But I think the problem all along has been that this has never been the important negotiation. This has never been the critical negotiation. It is the future relationship which
is
the
critical negotiation. That gets forgotten.
I think that the really big thing is we're actually seeing the disintegration of a country here. And I think sometimes we get bogged down in timetables about the council and this and that and the customs union. What we're seeing in England is the end of Theresa May, the end of the Conservative Party,
And I wonder.
And the disintegration of the union. And this is actually going to happen. And I think we don't... Sometimes, you know, people say when you see these great events, you know, people go back to people in the First World War and the Second World War. How the hell did that happen? How did the country go from... You ask, you know, Germans, you know, years ago, how did that happen in the 1930s? And what you see is these extraordinary events which are much, much bigger than we tend to accept, because our brain isn't able to accept these extraordinary events. I think we're seeing the disintegration. I think you're seeing a good country going bad very, very, very quickly. And I think you see exactly the same type of checklist. You know, you start a movement, you then belittle the politics. So the movement is a Brexit movement. It's not really a party. It's a feeling. It's a notion. And then you start belittling mainstream politics by saying they're all experts. And then you start to lie. The elite. And then you start to lie.
They've been lying a long time now.
And you lie and you lie. Yeah. And then you recreate your own notion of what it is to be a citizen of the country, which is a totally fabricated idea, but it's your idea. You get people behind you, and every so often you're chipping away at the authority of the state, which in general is a good thing in most countries, okay?
Marianne,
and at the end you get to a situation where the Prime Minister... At the end you get to a situation where the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is invoking the people last Wednesday... over and above the Parliament. This is how countries... This is how countries disintegrate. And I think that in Ireland we're kind of... we have a slightly anti-English bias. All of us have. Let's accept that, right? It always
comes
out.
We're working on not being...
I know, but
like
we have
that.
It, Mark. Yeah. We have it for
except
all...
Except in rugby, we'll continue to...
And you wouldn't have a pretty anti-English bias in rugby, in fairness, right? nothing so enraptures us as beating those lads, right? But I think we should see the really big picture, that what is going on in Britain is something really profound and will have dramatic ramifications for us. And I'm not sure if the European Union will be our last line of defence.
Right.
This week, I mean, to be specific rather than general, is going to be crucial. They are up, the ERG, the DUP will be up against the wall this week. I mean, we're going to have... Theresa May was planning to introduce the withdrawal agreement on Tuesday. She's now decided not to do so. You will have these indicative votes to clarify what the House wants.
Yeah.
If it can't agree...
But they can't. She may not be binding.
Indeed. But if they can't agree, or even... they won't be binding, but even... then she's going to introduce the agreement again on Thursday as a last ditch.
And you know
and
that
it may work.
Yeah, it may
time.
Work. But because I heard a lot of people last night giving out about the million people on the street and saying looking for another referendum is anti-democratic. We voted. We made a decision. Yeah. But in the House of Commons, you keep throwing the same thing in all over again. Right. And that is considered democratic. I just want to read out one caller to you. Your guests are delusional. Hungary, Italy, Poland, Austria are all on course for conflict with Brussels. Frexit polling at 40% in France. The EU is no longer fit for purpose. Time to disband this unaccountable protectionist racket. Well, you can see clearly where that person is coming from. There's an element of truth in there. Can I come to you, Mary, about the detail that people... I've done that again.
Jean,
sorry,
it's okay.
Jean.
It's all right.
about... it's not just a case of packing your bag and walking out the door. That is much more complex than that.
In terms of Britain actually leaving the European Union, for sure. And I think what people have seen now is the complexity that's there. And I think what's happened to a large extent is that the last 2.5 years, which should have been used in very detailed preparations for departure, were not used as well as they could have been. And a deadline has a way of coming up against you whether you wanted to or not. So she has frankly run out of time. I mean, for myself, watching the that extraordinary broadcast during the week, I mean, it's only a small detail of it. She arrived to the camera 30 minutes late. Millions of people in her country were waiting and watching for her to come out and make a statement.
And in this country.
Yeah. Lots of swearing at the TV in my house. And she made this extraordinary statement, and it reminded me an awful lot of 16 years ago when, you know, Tony Blair's kind of... when the gloss started to go off Tony Blair because he was at odds with majority of his people about the Iraq war. Exact same thing. Millions of people taken to the streets. The thing that I remember most, I think, about her speech during the week on Wednesday night was... really just feeling baffled by it, I think, more than anything else. She kept referring to you.
And I know what you think, and I
don't know who the you was that she was addressing. You know, it has that feeling of almost looking behind you in a room to see, is there someone behind you that she's addressing? It was no one I knew.
I was in Brussels all weekend. Yeah. The feeling was just immense irritation because every time the EU has got to a point where they thought she might be able to deliver on the commitments that she's made to the EU, December 2017, the joint agreement, the November deal that she resigned
from. She's running a minority government.
That's right.
Minority governments are greatly restricted, which anybody in Fine Gael would tell you.
Their conclusion was, I think, that we have to take control of this process, but not overtly, and the House of Commons has got to do that in London. And that's, I think, how we explain the decisions that were taken on Thursday in the
Council. Can I come back to you, Jean? You have clients coming to you for advice. Quite a lot of clients.
Yeah, I mean, speaking professionally, it's great to be busy on Brexit-related queries, but speaking personally, I'd rather not have that work and not have Britain leaving the Union, and I'm not being sanctimonious when I say that. I really genuinely mean that. So where we see Brexit, having impact in a law firm, clients are coming in inquiring about broadcasting licences, inquiring about data transfers, because the free movement of personal data that we've all had for 40, 45 years is about to come to an end. And just on a human level, I see it every day in friends that have made a professional life in London deciding to come home. Again, it's terrific for us. It's awful to say it, but, lawyers need more lawyers at the moment. And to see people relocating home, they're not necessarily happy about leaving the UK, but they've decided that they want to make a life here. And that's just on a personal level very sad.
I think a lot of people of different nationalities were kind of hurt. I spoke to a number of Irish people living over there that just felt hurt, which is kind of just an ordinary human thing to feel. David, do you think, if we just think crassly, that this...
We always think crassly. I've never thought any other way.
It's an economic question,
obviously. You've had a career out of it.
That this is not the cliff edge that we're all scared of?
No, I don't think so. I think that economics is really odd in the sense that what really, and I've said this for a long time, it's been a very unpopular thing to say. I said it at the very start, people saying Brexit's going to be a nightmare. That what really trips you up in economics is unexpected things, okay? And what really trips you up in business and finance is unexpected things. Like, for example, a property crash that most people didn't expect. It's like you're rich one day, you're poor the next day.
Yeah.
And it's Hemingway, Hemingway was asked, how did he go bankrupt? And he said, first, slowly, and then very quickly. So that's this idea, that basically Brexit has been so ventilated that now it is really in the realms of the European Council and politicians and all that sort of stuff. My sense is that when an event is so well flagged, it will come as a blessed relief to everybody that it arrives. And what really affects economics is expectations, right? And people's expectations have been pretty much locked into and thinking about Brexit for a long time. The other side, so the idea that it's a one-off event that changes the world doesn't work in my mind. The second thing is, if you look at the Irish economy, the Irish economy is two bits, really. The really productive bit is this bit that's a cog in the global economy, supply chain. And in that world, we compete with Britain 50-50 for people and for capital, okay? And people, as we've had a discussion about immigration, go to the place that's most welcoming at some level. And money, capital, goes to it follows the path of water, the path of least resistance, okay? So if there's a doubt in your head, capital will not go. So my sense is that the 50-50 decisions of people and capital for Ireland over Britain will go to Ireland. It's not... the official Irish policy, I think, largely driven by the Department of Foreign Affairs, is this is a nightmare because it creates also political and issues. But on the economy, and this is where we're talking about, Marion, I do not think that Brexit will be the huge disaster that people have suggested it's going to be. And also, if you look at what's happening, had Brexit been the huge disaster that people were going to be, there probably would have been a profound effect already. And in fact, the opposite has happened. The Irish economy has been expanding at a rate of knots not since Brexit, but in that time frame. So I think a lot of people just to think logically rather than emotionally. And the other thing is also sometimes when you lose something, particularly the officialdom of a country, you lose the status quo, it changes, tend to be slightly more neurotic. And actually, if you look at as the people doing business and the people travelling over abroad to the UK, there is a sense that I think that if it comes, it'll be a blessed relief.
Okay, Mary, I mean, the Department of Foreign Affairs has got tremendous praise, and people have said that they have really kept the contacts going right around with every country. But if you take on board what David is saying, is it about business and solidarity, or is the predominant thing the fear of the Good Friday Agreement and the border and the awful spectre of sectarianism developing again and violence?
I agree with David on one issue. I don't think there'll be a huge change day after Brexit if it's a hard Brexit. But I think within a year, within 2 years, we will have seen very, very profound problems arising. And those problems are because of the nature of the links between Ireland and Britain and between Britain and Europe and Ireland and Europe. And I think those issues will permeate the economy, will permeate the political situation, north and south. And I think they will be very, very profound. Of course, they'll be very profound. You can't separate from Britain, or you can't have Britain separating from Europe and not have those impacts.
Well, we did it 100 years ago in a different way.
And look what happened. Look what happened. And then we had an economic war just to make sure that it got really bad. And then we had Guinness's moving their headquarters from Dublin to Park Lane.
We didn't recover till 1973 when we rejoined the EU.
We actually didn't recover till 1993. Yes. We joined the EU and we still were going downwards. That was the problem.
And maybe why we are so worried is because we know how we didn't do it maybe the last time ourselves, and we know what the British seem to be doing this time only too well. We had our civil war, you could say they're having their civil war.
Yeah, but just skip the violence, but the same level of
partition England. There's no way that this is not going to have a profound impact.
Yeah. You wanted to come in on.
Sorry, just a glib point. We should partition England and keep the South and leave the North of England and Wales go off. Just like happened 100 years ago. No, there is a point here. All this discussion is, and it reflects what's happening nationally in Ireland as opposed to what John experienced in Brussels, is almost like we're following every bounce of the ball, every vote in the House of Commons, paying a lot of attention to it. It's energy sapping just to keep all of this going.
It is, yeah.
What happened on Thursday night was a very clear message from the 27, we're taking control of this. It was described as 90 minutes of nothing. Theresa May, or Theresa June, as some people are calling her now. But Theresa May is...
she's getting a lot of personal abuse, which is a pity.
The pitch to the European Union was... didn't get any reception whatsoever, because the opposite is happening of what Boris Johnson said early in the days. We have all the cards. Europe has all the cards. What does Europe do next? It is time to call in Britain and say there are 4 million signatures. You're supposed to consider a petition with 100,000. There's 1 million on the streets. It's time for a second referendum. Last time round, they had a referendum without a debate. It was all bendy bananas and messages on German-built buses. They are now having their debate without the referendum. It's time for Europe to lay that on the condition for whatever else she comes back when she's nowhere to turn at the end of this week and say this is the condition.
Two things. We keep hearing about the 17 million who voted to leave. What about the 16 million who voted to remain?
Hold on, you're saying that one vote is of more consequence.
No,
do you remember our divorce referendum?
You know,
and there was a squeak
through. I know, but the point is, an issue of this magnitude, there should be a two-thirds,
whatever.
David Davis, to come back. To David's point about the impact on the economy. Fine, for certain sectors of the economy, the impact will not be as severe as it will be for the rural economy and for agriculture in particular. And a study last week in Germany pointed out that a hard Brexit will cost the UK, the ordinary person in the UK, about 900 a year. Here it'll cost us 700 plus a year per man, woman and child. Those will be the economic consequences. And our agriculture industry is going to take a terrible whacking.
Depending on the form that Brexit takes.
I'm not belittling
what is likely to happen in agriculture, but you have two things on, right? If they crash out, tariffs are imposed on English consumers. Mm. We don't pay anything, okay? So the tariffs are, this is something we don't realise, that tariffs are not imposed on us, the exporter. They're imposed on people who buy the stuff. And the second thing is, England is so dependent on Irish agriculture, so dependent, that...
No.
Now,
what about Brazil? Cheap meat from Brazil?
But again, there's not a huge momentum in the UK for people to actually drop their agricultural standards so that they'll take meat from any old person.
I'm just saying
is that if you look...
Cheap food,
if
they
you,
like
if
that.
If you look, there, there have been... there ha- with regard to Brexit, the likelihood is that the overall impact on Ireland will not be as bad as people think. The second thing is, if it's likely that the customs union soft, wishy-washy Brexit is the end game, this is going to be incredibly positive for us. And this is the, still the likely outcome.
Okay.
We could see wine lakes again are the equivalent of milk lakes, cheddar, and buying into intervention, I think, to protect Irish agriculture for a period.
Okay, listen, I just before we go to the nice stuff with you on, I want to come to the story in the Mail on Sunday about this woman, Patricia Donovan, who says she was abused from the age of five by Eamon Casey, accused of sexual abuse. I think people will be very shocked, and I hope very sympathetic to the woman and to the other two who went to the redress board and got settlements. So it's kind of much more serious than one allegation, though it's obviously massively...
There were 13
serious
allegations. Marion, that story first emerged in 2005.
Did it really?
Yes, yeah. And Bishop Casey at the time was in the Diocese of Arundel and Brighton. He was in a parish down there and chaplain to a hospital. And he had to stand aside from ministry while the allegations were being investigated. There were 13 separate allegations. And that was in November 2005. And it was investigated by the Gardaí here because the allegations were alleged to have taken place here, though the woman herself is living in the UK and has been. And he wasn't the only one accused. But the DPP brought no charges. And it was announced in August 2006 that he was bringing no charges. I'm puzzled by the redress, residential institutions redress board payment, because all of that is highly confidential by law. And I mean, would it suggest that Bishop Casey abused somebody who'd been in an institution as a child, in an orphanage, reformatory or industrial school? I've never heard that said before. I just don't know. I'm puzzled by it, that's all.
And you have been around this story
for more years than I care to remember.
Yeah, not the most pleasant story to be the expert on.
Yeah.
So what are you saying to me?
I mean, as I said, these allegations first emerged in 2005 when he was in the Diocese of Arundel and Brighton.
And did the British investigate
no,
that?
No, they were investigated here because the incidents were alleged to have happened in Ireland.
All right.
And it was known that she was a relative of Bishop Casey's at the time, that that wasn't publicised. And as I said, he wasn't the only person accused by her. So, I mean, she's clearly had a relationship with, in terms of being helped by the Diocese of Galway. Bishop Martin Drennan is quoted in that article today. Bishop Willie Walsh was quoted in that article today, the former Bishop of Killaloe, who at the time said that Bishop Casey hadn't been dealt with in a just fashion. But apparently she complained in 2010 when she heard that Bishop Casey was to officiate at a baptism, and Bishop Walsh advised him not to do so. I think that was for whatever reason. All I'm saying is that, very few abuse victims make false allegations. That's proven again and again
over
and again.
And over.
About the low percentages are false. But I just don't know. There are a lot of holes in this. That's what I say. I'm not saying she's. I just don't know.
Jean?
I mean, it's a dreadful story. And the man, of course, I'm unconscious, is dead and no longer around to defend his own name. The angle for me that's interesting is the retention of records bill, which is referred to in a side column there by Anne Sheridan in the piece on page 9 of the Mail. And she talks about that bill, which is going through the Oireachtas and will be before the Dáil next week, apparently, under which certain records of allegations like these may be put under seal for a number of years. And, you know, there's always that tension between, you know, the right of victims and people who are accused to not have their names sullied. But in this one, I think it's interesting because people may have made statements before various commissions under assurances that information would not be brought out during their lifetime. So it's a really delicate issue. Actually, I have to say, before I read the article in the Mail, I wasn't aware that particular bill was coming for the Dáil next week. But it's one I'll be watching closely.
And it's to be reviewed in 25 years' time. But the real point about this is that the legislation under which the Redress Board was set up and the Ryan Commission was set up guaranteed people confidentiality. Mm. And there was, in fact, a confidential branch whereby people could go and tell their stories on the understanding that it would never be talked about.
Yep.
And when it came to the public investigations of the Ryan Commission, the people who were abused were investigated privately. The people who were the representatives of the 18 religious congregations were interrogated, that's the word to use, publicly. I know because I reported on it in 2005, 2006. So I can see why, in the interest of the people who were abused, why these records are being preserved for 75 years to protect them, because that was the understanding in which they gave the evidence.
If those kind of assurances weren't honoured, people would be less likely to come forward, so that's devoutly.
And if you give your word, it should be honoured.
Well, I sometimes say put not your faith in politicians, there were women that left who'd had babies and guarantees and guarantees and guarantees and they've but we won't go there today. We'll take our last break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme and the problem. Yeah. Owen Corrie, travel expertise out. There are two big stories relating to both air and sea travel making headlines. Let's start with the sea and not the Norwegian one. Dublin port to reduce the number of cruise ships coming into Dublin in 2 years' time. Why?
They need 120 million euro to build a pier. This is basically what's at the heart of this. There's the cruise ship income in Dublin Port is about 2 million a year. They get about 160 calls. It's growing and growing and growing. It's going to hit 200 if they keep running at this level. And the income from it doesn't justify spending 120 million of their own money on a pier. So they've said we're going to cap it at 80. And they are going to have two berths where two cruise ships a week can come in. The really sad part of this, Marion, is that we're at the cusp of something very, very big in Irish tourism in general, in that cruise ships have been calling for about 20 years, coming in, everybody spills off, they all go to the Guinness storehouse, the Book of Kells. The real money and the real action in cruise is when your ship starts in Dublin, comes back to Dublin, takes the passengers all on, 2,500 to 4,000 of them, puts them all back off again. They all fly home. What advantage does Dublin have? Its airport through the tunnel is about 15 minutes away from the port.
Right.
And most of the people coming to board in Dublin are boarding the two cruise lines that have mini-series here, mini-seasons here, Celebrity and Princess. They're bringing them in from North America. For the first time, they're talking about doing a full season from about 2020, 2021. This has got headlines throughout the cruise industry. Dublin is no longer welcoming cruise passengers. It's a disaster.
Okay. Airlines, Ethiopian Airlines, 157 people on board. The Boeing 737 MAX. What's the story with that? And how long is it going to take to find out what the story is? And what are the implications for the airlines? I gather Norwegian will be in awful difficulty.
Norwegian will have some of them. They were using them on the Irish routes. For instance, the Cork route to Providence, which was supposed to fly this summer, it's no longer bookable. Now, it's not that it's full. It's just that they are waiting for an alternative aircraft. Their chances of getting it are very limited. They are at the moment got a provision and a contingency plan in where they're using a 787 Dreamliner, but Cork people who have booked on it will be bused to Dublin, flown to Stewart International in New York, and then bused to Providence, 3 hours the other side.
Oh God.
It's a big problem for Norwegian because they've already taken their delivery. It's a big problem for the likes of Jet Airways in India, which are in very wobbly state, that have taken a big delivery. Boeing, it's an existential crisis for them. They've 1,500 of these on order. Unless they get it right, we've had the first cancellation this week, the entire business model is in danger. And where really Ireland is concerned in this, Ryanair have ordered 200 of these. Now, Ryanair is saying Boeing will sort it out. It's not our problem. The problem in one line is that the engines are a little bit heavier, a little bit further forward to the front, and a software system was installed so that pilots that had flown the previous 737s could fly it. And now, I know Ryanair, what will happen is, if the MAX doesn't get certified, they'll say, I'll do you a favour. You're supposed to close down the previous version of this, continue the line on, we'll buy 200 of those and give us a 20% discount.
Crossed my mind too, I have to say. Mm. Though they do put, and they always stress safety, but presumably there's going to be a resolution. Now, you were at a big French tourism event this week, concerns over Gilets Jaunes, and you had experience of
I was in France for a weekend, a couple of days, 48-hour trip in December, and I managed to arrive in the Champs-Élysées and be tear-gassed. So there you go. There's a memorable weekend
right.
in France.
And your young son got a standing ovation.
Well,
his 10-year-old, when he told him in school the following day.
He was describing it in school at assembly the following week. It was certainly a very memorable trip to Paris, but there's nothing
you will always have
a 10-year-old enjoy a bit of drama. Were you there?
I was tear-gassed at the UEFA Cup final in 19, between Arsenal and Real Saragossa, and I was in the Arsenal end, and we were tear gassed. We've both been tear gassed by French cups.
It's called experiential tourism.
Yeah, that's right. It's a whole new thing.
Listen, we'll leave it at that for the moment. And my thanks to absolutely everybody that contributed to the programme today.